Thomas Vargas, and you're listening to episode 24 of the Art Scene Podcast. Before I introduce our guest today, let me tell you about a couple shows going on right now in the Bay Area. First, Nando Alvarez Perez, who has previously been on the podcast, has a solo show currently on exhibit at Interface Gallery in Oakland titled Portentology that runs till November 26th. The gallery is open Fridays through Sundays from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., so check it out if you can. Our friends at Bass and Rainer Gallery also have a new show up titled Self World, which includes the works of Lisa Jones Taylor and Jack Schneider. Where they present environments or ecologies as sites for unique or individualized experiences across species. The show runs till December 2nd at the Minnesota Street Project in San Francisco. Now onto our guest. This week I had the pleasure of speaking with Rio Yanez, an artist and curator born and raised in San Francisco's Mission District. I had the pleasure of talking to him about the various projects he has worked on here in the Bay Area, as well as exhibits he has collaborated with his father, Rene Yanez, the most recent being the annual Day of the Dead exhibition at Soma Arts, titled Remembrance and Resistance, Día de los Muertos. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Thanks for having me over at your place. I don't make it very often out here, but it's always a nice treat to like come into people's homes over here in the East Bay in Oakland.
Hey, welcome to Oakland.
How long have you been here?
So I have been living in Oakland for the last 4 years now. We're in the Fruitvale neighborhood, like the movie with Michael B. Jordan.
We're just two blocks away from that stop.
Right? Two blocks from the Fruitvale BART station, and it's interesting because where we're at right now is kind of the apex, the crossing point of the Black and Latino kind of areas of the Fruitvale, and right here at 34th and International is kind of where they meet and then diverge. So it's kind of an interesting spot.
Yeah.
As someone who grew up in San Francisco in the Mission District in the 80s and 90s, it's very reminiscent of that. There's a lot of families, a lot of kids running around. There's a certain energy to it, which I was missing in San Francisco. And it's real hood and dangerous, too, which is it's kind of beautiful and kind of, you know, it's everything.
Right.
It's everything all at once. It definitely reminds me of my childhood. It's kind of a second shot at that.
Sure. So I actually first heard of you because of Instagram. I follow Soma Arts on Instagram, and I saw randomly a post about opening up the Dia de los Muertos exhibition at Soma Arts. And I saw that it was an annual exhibition, and I also read that you and your father, Rene, were actually put it together. They mm-hmm. come up with a theme and curated it. And so I just was like, I have to find out who they are. And actually we'll talk a little bit about it later because it just slipped my mind. I was like, oh, I know who your dad is. And I had actually learned about him in school and just like learning about when I went to art school and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to talk to you because I mean, I read that you were from here, from the Bay Area, and this was an annual exhibition. How long has this show been going on?
Well, my dad, Rene Yanez, has been curating Dia de los Muertos shows since 1971.
Yeah.
Where he started at Galería de la Raza in the Mission District. He migrated the show. The show went to several galleries over the years, several art spaces, including the Mission Cultural Center, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, and I believe in 2001 it settled at SOMARTS, the South of Market Cultural Center. I've been collaborating with him on the exhibit since 2005.
Sure.
So this is my 12th year working with him to produce the show.
And so you mentioned the Mission District, and that's where you're from, right? You're mm-hmm. born and raised. And tell me a little bit about growing up there. Tell me a little bit more because both your parents are actually well-known artists. Like, I mean, at least in the Chicano community, like historically they have a role. So I'm interested to see what your upbringing was like in the Mission District because you were constantly surrounded by art, which is not, you know, a norm, right? Like there's not a lot of kids that grow up being surrounded by so much like activity, you know, in the art community.
Yeah. I mean, I was very fortunate to have kind of a Chicano art wonder years upbringing, you know, and I think, as any kid, there's a lot you take for granted. So while, you know, I was in the presence of kind of all these incredible Chicano artists and seeing all these revolutionary art shows. I still had my face buried in X-Men comic books because, that's where my heart really was. And it wasn't until a lot of it just is in retrospect, realizing just how fortunate and lucky I was.
Yeah.
And, growing up in the Mission and in the Chicano Latino art scene there, it was a mixture of things because it was incredibly dangerous. I mean, people were getting killed for their shoes on the street. But at the same time, it was this kind of renaissance in the 80s of kind of new technologies, of murals really getting a foothold in the community, of Dia de los Muertos, of Carnival, of all these kind of what I would consider cultural institutions of San Francisco and of kind of the Chicano Latino art scene in San Francisco, gaining a foothold and kind of becoming part of the neighborhood culture. So it was really beautiful and amazing and, kind of terrifying at the same time, especially to be a young person. I mean, my parents, if you would have seen photos of me, I wore black, gray, and white. There was no color because it was incredibly dangerous.
Sure.
I grew up in the Norteño side of town, but it was just like, you could never be too sure. And so... Yeah. I guess a lot of beautiful creative things, but also a healthy dose of danger and paranoia thrown in there.
Sure. And just briefly, because I don't think all our listeners will know, but a brief background, who your mom and your dad is.
So my dad is Rene Yanez. He is a artist and curator. I would say he's primarily known as a curator. He was one of the co-founders of Galería de la Raza in the Mission District and, has, I think, played a really crucial role in kind of establishing Day of the Dead as not just kind of a personal or spiritual practice, but as an art practice. And, I think a lot of the Day of the Dead art exhibits that we see nationally kind of stem from the risks that he was taking with it in the early 70s.
And your mother also too.
And my mom is Yolanda Lopez. She is a painter, among other things. I think she would probably call herself a media artist, but the world primarily knows her as a painter. She's known for the series of the portraits of the women in her family as the Virgen de Guadalupe, as well as the iconic poster of the Aztec warrior crumpling immigration papers, and it says, "Who's the illegal alien pilgrim?" And I would say, growing up, my mother's son, it was, there was more than my dad. I think I got caught up in the politics of art making with my mom, because there was frequently a lot of pushback against her work, both externally from, she had a whole series on Mexican stereotypes, and she collected all these media images of Mexican stereotypes, and it upset a lot of white people in the 80s when she exhibited them.
Naturally.
And also her images of herself and the women in her family as the Virgen de Guadalupe internally upset a lot of Catholics, a lot of Guadalupanos, a lot of people who thought it was very sacrilegious. So I grew up seeing my mom take a lot of flack for her work and having to stand up and defend her work and justify her work. And I think that was probably one of the major kind of defining experiences as a second generation artist is seeing my mom definitely suffer the slings and arrows of her practice.
Yeah. And, now, going back to you, you're growing up with these two parents who are in it. They're in the movement. They're making art. They're making statements. You just described your mom getting flack. At this point, 8 to 13 years old, are you aware of, this? Like, is it influencing what you wanted to do for the rest of your life? Like, I want to be in the art community like my parents, or was that something that came later and then you were just more aware of it and more sympathetic to the art community, but not necessarily you wanted to make a career out of it?
Well, I think I was, from a young age, I was very aware of the struggles that my parents had, both all the politics, the chisme, the blowback from the work that they did. I was very aware of it. And I definitely wanted to be in the arts, but as a kid, I was completely captivated by comic books.
Yeah.
So that's where I saw my, what I was going to do in the arts was to draw comic books or to write comic books.
Sure.
And it wasn't until I got much older and really found, you know, a creative outlet that I felt could sustain me that I felt, you know, that I felt more as a second generation artist that there was kind of a almost like a family practice or a family craft that was being passed down. And really what that ended up being was curating. And that's what I've done with my dad for 12 years now.
Sure.
But it was never really sugarcoated for me growing up. I mean, my parents, whenever I said I wanted to be an artist, they always joked that it was just, I was taking a vow of poverty. and I wouldn't say they quite discouraged me, but it was always like, you know what you're getting into. Yeah. Like it's, yeah, it wasn't easy. And yeah, I mean, the Chicano art world is rife with politics. And so my parents were always kind of knee deep in it.
Yeah.
So it was never idealized for me, that I'll say that much.
And so you were making art though, right? As a kid, like you were doing like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. And it was it comic book drawings?
Yeah. I mean, I from as long as I could walk, I was kind of doing crude drawings of Batman and, you know, spacemen shooting at each other. And I was, when I was a kid, I was really taken in by Godzilla. So a lot of my work, you know, was Godzilla destroying cityscapes. And I think I got in trouble a few times as a kid because I would just constantly draw Godzilla terrorizing these like skyscrapers. And I think teachers thought it was like a cry for help, or I was like going to be really violent, or, you know, it was, I think there was a lot of concern over all the Godzilla art that I produced when I was a kid.
And why Godzilla?
I was just captivated by it. Yeah. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I saw the original Godzilla, the 1963 Godzilla black and white movie. It just blew my mind. I don't know if I could even walk, but I was just a baby.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget like that image of Godzilla. You know, it's kind of ingrained in my head.
And, yeah.
When I was 5 years old, my parents took me to go see Godzilla 1985 at the Lumiere Theater in San Francisco, and it was a life-changing experience for me. Like that, it was like almost like discovering religion at that point. It had a really profound effect on me, and I just the whole mythology that, you know, the Godzilla films had built over the years, the kind of the power, the destructive power of it. You know, as I got older, I kind of understood and I could appreciate the political metaphors for it and kind of relating to Japan and nuclear power. And,
sure.
But as a kid, it was just mind-blowing, mind-melting, you know, and that's what inspired me and a lot of my childhood drawings.
Yeah, and, you know, and you do graphic design type work too, right? I saw on your site a little bit that just the style of it is very reminiscent of, like, this is a kid that this is a guy who read comic books as a kid.
Yes. Yeah. I do graphic work and graphic design. Right now I'm in the process of finishing out some merchandising for Brava Theater. They're doing a screening of Beyonce's Lemonade.
Oh, wow.
So I've been doing some posters and pins and posters, like publicity posters for them. So that's the kind of stuff I do now on the side.
Right.
But definitely, I mean, the art that I grew up with, you know, doing and you know, being gravitated towards was definitely stems from all those Godzilla movies.
Sure. And you mentioned, you know, I read, you know, just looking you up, you mentioned, you know, in your bio about being frustrated with Chicano art and iconography because it didn't intersect with the pop culture you grew up liking. So the pop culture, obviously, we're talking about comic books and your fascination with Godzilla. Explain that a little bit.
Well, I think growing up, I was always told, you know, that the art I was seeing was important, that it had value, that, you know, it was historical or history in the making. You know, I'd seen an Enrique Chagoya print and, you know, and seen him working on it. I mean, not just seeing it, but seeing it be produced and being that fortunate and lucky, but also kind of being a brat about it. And, you know, like, why is Enrique Chagoya, you know, doing a portrait of like Che or Frida and not like Hulk Hogan or Wolverine from the X-Men? Or, you know, like I I always question why those two things didn't overlap.
Yeah.
And of course, when they did, I that was, you know, incredibly inspiring and exciting for me. But
yeah, because he puts like Superman and Mickey Mouse into some of his plans. But I would assume those are a little older than what you, like, characters than what you were reading about. Like, you're talking about X-Men and stuff.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, I mean, I was kind of a brat about it. A lot of it, when you're 6 years old, you take a lot for granted.
Sure.
And so it wasn't until much later that I could really appreciate how fortunate I was in that context.
Yeah. And so, you know, now... Actually, going back to that, I can relate to that. Because growing up for me, I remember my mother... I kid you not. I mean, maybe you had the same experience too. My mother was from Tijuana in Mexico. But we ended up, you know, she married a Latino man, but he was American for all... I mean, he grew up in New Orleans, for God's sakes. But he very American-minded. But growing up, I remember going home and learning about some subject in history and then just being hammered about, like, well, you know, that's wrong. You know about that California history. And then it just turned into a lecture. It was, like, things, I think normal things, like, that I liked, that I wanted to like, go to homecoming dances, go to a football game, stuff like that. You know, like, just the intersection of the pop culture that I grew up with and American pop culture just not intersecting with, or, you know, with my parents' like, history lessons of my culture. And so I think the intersection of it never really happened for me. It took me a while till I got older for it to really connect.
I mean, I remember really annoying my mom once, because this was during when the United Farm Workers had declared the grape boycott.
Yeah.
And I think we were in a Safeway, and I kept asking my mom, was like, well, does that include like grape soda? Is that include like grape now and laters? Like grape double bubble? I just kept like pulling all these like grape flavored items that probably had no traces of grape in them whatsoever.
Right.
But, you know, I just kept like prodding and asking and, you know, like, I was just curious. I didn't understand, like, you know, we were boycotting grapes, but how far did that extend?
Right. Yeah. So now, like, you're in your high school years now and you're about to, you know, you're thinking about going to college. Mm-hmm. Did you know what you wanted to do, like, or at least what school you wanted to go to and what route in the art world you wanted to take?
Yeah, I in school, I really fell in love with photography. I took a lot of drawing and painting classes in high school, and pretty much I came close to failing about all of them because when I do my own, like, visual art, like illustrative visual art, the time that I need to work was not compatible with the kind of rigorous academic deadlines of the classes that I was taking. So I would like straddle like a C-D+ for most of my art classes because I couldn't meet the deadlines.
Yeah.
It just wasn't how my process worked. And I think my parents could see that because they were artists and they knew, you know, they knew what their kind of timeline or the energy or the bandwidth it took for them to do their work. So they kind of got it, but it was still, like, I had a lot of drama, a lot of, you know, sad feelings about not being able to, you know, or just barely passing these art classes when that's really what I wanted to do.
Sure.
And so at that point, I turned to photography, and I brought a camera with me. This is in the 90s, so this is, like, pre-cell phones, pre-cell phone cameras. I just had a point-and-shoot camera that I would bring with me in my backpack every single day, and I'd shoot, you know, every couple days, I'd shoot a whole roll of film of my friends, of the school, and I just got really, really into photography. And my mom pushed me to go to this summer program called the California State Summer School for the Arts, and what that was is I ended up going to CalArts, California Institute of the Arts, the summer before my senior year of high school. And I lived on campus, and I took kind of college-level art classes there. And that really was a big milestone for me, because it was the first time I felt like I was really taken seriously as an artist. And the work that I was doing was taken seriously.
Yeah.
And so my goal at that point was to, one, go to CalArts, and two, to study photography. And that pretty much set my course. I graduated high school. I did end up going to the City College of San Francisco because we couldn't really afford to send me anywhere else. So I I took my like general classes there, but I also studied photography. And when I could kind of, you know, get all my academic units out of the way, I just kind of I went to CalArts, and yeah, I made my majors in photography. And the timing of it is a little weird because it was when I graduated in 2005 with a BFA in photography, it was kind of the analog photography was basically going extinct. And more than that, I think photography was being democratized in a way that made it really accessible to everyone, mm-hmm. but in a way it kind of really devalued what my practice would right. be as a photographer. And I think that's just the nature of how, you know, art
right.
and visual culture evolves. But yeah, it was kind of weird, like realizing just, you know, when I graduated with that degree in photography, that what a turning point it was for analog photography, that you would work in a dark room, develop everything, print your own photos, and having to really carefully edit what you shoot and what you print versus, you know, I have a camera with a memory card and you can shoot 3,000 photos and, you know, you can view them instantly on your computer. And, you know, at this point, with the amazing photos that our phones can now take.
I know. Like, I just found out that, like, someone just told me that the camera on our phones was better than, like, the Canon, digital SLR that I used to use in high school,
yeah.
like, 10 years ago. And I was just like, oh, my, like, how in the world did that happen?
Yeah, and yeah. I think it's beautiful. I mean, sure. I think that kind of accessibility, that kind of democracy, bringing that democracy to photography is incredible. But it's also, yeah, it's made, I think, being a professional photographer a little more challenging. It's, I think, forced a lot of people to adapt.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was really fortunate in that while I was studying photography there and spending all this time in the dark room, I was also taking all the digital-based classes that I could. So I'm learning Photoshop. And really, that was those digital classes, that foundation in Photoshop is what informed my practice kind of going forward. Because mm-hmm. I still do photography, but really my main emphasis is on digital arts and illustration.
And what kind of photographs were you taking in at CalArts? That's in LA, right? So you're in LA for a few years then.
Yeah, so it's in Santa Clarita, California, which is just a little less than an hour outside of Los Angeles, but really Los Angeles was the kind of cultural focal point. And it was a challenge for me because what I had actually done prior to that was photograph my neighborhood, the Mission District, and kind of document a lot of the gentrification that was going on in the late 90s, early 2000s, shooting a lot of like personal photographs of friends, and suddenly being transplanted to Southern California, like I didn't have access to any of that, and I really had to reinvent myself.
Yeah.
And so it was definitely a struggle. Like I struggled to kind of find my place, you know, kind of removed from my neighborhood and
yeah.
and what I was so familiar with, and that was the basis of my work. And now I was in LA, and you know, a lot of it I ended up looking inward and doing a lot of photo series on identity and what it means to be Chicano and what it means to kind of culturally present yourself as Chicano. Mm-hmm. My senior thesis show was kind of this photo collage of, I had this Mexican wrestling character, where I dress up in a mask, and I was really into Santo and Blue Demon movies growing up. So, and I went around and kind of interrogated, white and Latino comic book characters, and I would Photoshop myself into different comic books kind of in search for like the kind of Chicano images in mainstream comic books. Sure. And I was just kind of traveling through and interrogating all these comic books.
Creating that intersection that you wanted.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it really forced me to kind of look inward. And I was really grateful for that. It was a struggle at first. It was definitely a struggle to kind of figure out, like, I'm hundreds of miles away from everything I based my work on previously. Like, what do I do?
Yeah.
And it was really kind of looking inward that brought out what the majority of my work was there.
And when you graduated, did you stay in LA a little longer, or you just went straight back home?
I went straight back to the Bay Area.
Really missed it, huh?
Yeah, and I feel like, at least at the time, like LA, there were infinitely more possibilities and opportunities in LA, but I think the culture there was way more competitive.
Sure.
And I think growing up in the Bay Area, where there's more of a sense of collective and community and artists supporting each other, you know, that's where I wanted to be.
Yeah.
Not necessarily kind of in this like cutthroat thing where your friends are your competition all the time.
Well, and it kind of like ruins it for you, right? Especially the way you grew up, like learning that art can be a community and how supportive people is. So you don't want to like have it ruined by like the business side of it and the competitive side of it.
Definitely.
And so what's the first thing you did when you came back? That like, did you kind of you move back home and you're like, all right, I got to figure out what's my next step. If I'm going to like continue doing photography, if I'm going to like change it up to a different direction.
Yeah. And at that point, you know, I kind of had to reinvent myself again because the writing was definitely on the wall in terms of photography.
Right.
You know, when I graduated from CalArts in 2005, I haven't stepped back inside a darkroom since.
Really?
And I mean, even finding one is definitely a challenge.
Yeah, it is.
But I just started to experiment in Photoshop, and there was kind of a Chicano blogger scene that I was really into, and I didn't really blog myself, but there was a blog called Loteria Chicana that I was like really into, and it was, you know, at the time, like, brown folks didn't have a lot of representation, you know, and something as simple as just someone's personal blog about their lives, and being a Chicana, like, it was, I grabbed onto it and I didn't let go. And so I was really fascinated by this person's world. Her name is Cindy Mosqueda. She was she is a Chicana blogger. She's now in New York, but she was based in LA at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think her writing and her work kind of served as a model for what I wanted to do. So it was through her blog that I discovered Flickr, and I started all my like really early, you know, digital illustrations I uploaded to Flickr, and that was kind of where I found my first online community for my work.
Yeah.
I found my first audience through Flickr, and it all pretty much goes back to me discovering that one blog, having a model for what it meant to have like a Chicano or Chicana be a presence, have a following, and to kind of be on the front line of all of like the emerging social media. I mean, this was like 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
And so it was really, you know, exciting to have that kind of model for me to aspire to. And yeah, I mean, a lot of it goes just back to Loteria Chicana.
Wow. Yeah, and you've done, and you still do, a lot of different things. But I wanted to highlight a couple, because there's so many. It would take a long time. But, you know, a couple things I've read about is you did the Ghetto Frida Project. Mm-hmm. You worked with the Great Tortilla Conspiracy. And, I mean, you're a curator at Soma Arts. Mm-hmm. And on top of all of this, which I thought was interesting, is you seem to be popularly depicted in your friend's work. So, I mean, if you can touch on those things and tell me what they're about, like, and how they got started.
Yeah, the Frida series, I was just kind of messing around. Like I wanted to do something like a little pica, a little like push the envelope a little bit. And at the time I was reading this magazine called Mass Appeal, which I think is still around now, but circa like 2006, 2005, they had this great section in every magazine where they would kind of interview a fictional character. So Ghetto Frida actually started out as kind of a writing project where I would do interviews with this Frida character, and it's like Frida kind of adapting herself for the current age and trying to appeal to kind of the youth, and like, can we swear on this?
Oh, podcast? Yeah, absolutely.
So just like talking mad shit, you know, and but also giving me a voice to kind of satirize a lot of our own popular culture, like like one of the things like that I wrote in these interviews, like she kind of goes after like Lila Downs and says like, you know, every time she goes out in public, I should get a royalty check, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. So it was kind of a way for me to craft a little bit of humor and kind of talk about my thoughts on the contemporary art scene and do it through kind of Frida, but also this voice that was kind of like someone like a homegirl on the corner talking shit.
Yeah.
And so the visual component is kind of what I'm most known for, but it really did start out as kind of like this writing exercise I did. And the Great Tortilla Conspiracy is, we bill ourselves as the world's most dangerous tortilla art collective. And we've kind of fluctuated with our membership over the years, but at the core, there's four of us. Myself, my dad, and two printmakers, Joss Sands and Art Hazelwood. And it all started when, well, there is a distinct lineage of tortilla art in the Chicano community. Jose Montoya, for decades, experimented by heating up a coat hanger and burning images into tortillas. So there was tortilla art itself was a form that existed way before us. But Joss Sands, who's a printmaker, wanted to kind of experiment with the medium, and he started using like the t-shirt iron-on transfer paper.
Oh yeah.
So he would print images on these iron-on t-shirt transfer papers, and then he'd press them onto tortillas, and they would hold. And so I went to an event where he was handing out these tortillas with images on them. And I was just like blown away, and you know, my dad got really excited about them, and we talked to Joss, and we're like, oh, we should do something, like we could totally like make this like an art form, and like really, you know, like do it as an art form. And it took us a while to really kind of find what we wanted to do with it. We had a residency at the De Young Museum where we were there, and we were doing tortilla portraits where we'd shoot photos of people, print them on heat transfer paper, and then put them on tortillas, and then we'd had a tortilla gallery where all of our different artworks we would heat transfer onto tortillas. That was kind of how we started out, but really what's taken form over the years is this idea that we want to make something that's edible, that we can feed people with, and that, you know, one of the most subversive things you can do in art is to have your work be destroyed at the end of the process.
Right. Because so, they think it always has to be saved for the future and for history of all time.
Yeah. And, you know, over the years, we've kind of, both Joss and myself are very fascinated with Masonic imagery. So we've based ourselves off on Freemasons. So we wear these hats and aprons, but they have a lot of Masonic imagery on them.
Right.
We kind of present ourselves as mad scientists.
Sure.
And in the scientific exploration of what is tortilla art, we have a formula that allows us to silkscreen with edible inks.
Sure.
And it's actually quite tasty. It involves chocolate syrup. So, and just using a few other things as a medium to pass the syrup through the screen. And in doing that, we can take our artwork and silkscreen it directly on a tortilla and have it be edible.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the focus now is on political activism, on social justice. So we've shown up to a lot of political events, to protests, to certain art events, and silkscreening our work, silkscreening kind of political work onto tortillas.
Yeah.
Frequently we add some cheese, and we have a little grill, and we make quesadillas. And yeah, like I said, I think sometimes the most subversive thing you can do with your art is to have it be destroyed. And in this case, we're actually feeding people with our images.
Yeah.
And the chocolate syrup actually makes it taste pretty good.
Yeah. What is great about it is, it's two things. One, I mean, it sounds like the collective, you've definitely, based on the projects that you do, really grow or really change with the times, right? Or address the issues that are going on.
Yeah.
And so that's really great. Like, you guys aren't just doing what you initially did. You're changing it to go along with whatever the latest issues are. I thought what was great is that you're appropriating symbols and traditions of like, or like just like costumes of the Masonic order which historically is a predominantly European white, like, mm-hmm. had origin that was not very diverse or very, you know, about being inclusive with other races. So I think that's great that, like, that you guys were really, I mean, that's the, for me, the bigger, the other statement that I feel like you're adding on to that too.
Yeah. I mean, I'll kind of pull back the curtain and I'll say that Joss and myself are big fans of the writer Dan Brown, the guy who wrote the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
And I think just the whole idea of taking, like, I mean, the Da Vinci Code is so over the top with, like, multi-layered conspiracies and secret societies, and we thought it would be kind of fun to take, like, copy and paste that mythology into the concept of putting artwork on tortillas.
Yeah.
So that's why we're the Great Tortilla Conspiracy. And so, yeah, and I think to a certain extent, it's kind of fun to bring a little bit of equal weight to tortilla art as you would, like, I mean, the talking about the works of, like, Leonardo da Vinci, you know, sure. And, you know, everything that surrounds that. And it's just allowed us to have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think of all the things I do, that's the most fun. And... you know, I think it allows us to do a lot of provocative things. I mean, we went to an event shortly after Nancy Reagan died, and we printed up hundreds of Nancy Reagan in Hell commemorative tortillas and handed them out to people. And, you know, we definitely got some pushback on it, but it was also, you know, like, it was our chance to kind of, you know, put something out there that in any other medium you would have a hard time distributing, but because it was food that people could eat, it was much more accessible for just the average person off the street.
Yeah, and people forget the bad history that she has with minorities in this country.
Yes, definitely.
I think I read somewhere, what's the City of Quartz, that book, that one of the stories, I forget his name who wrote the book, but one of the stories in there was about, he opens it with the commissioner of LAPD is sitting with Nancy Reagan, and they're, like, in their, you know, their LAPD windbreaker jackets, and they're across the street, and they're about to witness basically a raid, a drug raid, because they got, like, some, they wanted to show her, like, this is where all the money's going to, and they completely, like, demolished, like, a four-unit apartment complex. Mm-hmm. And in the end, all they found was, like, a bag of weed on, like, a 14-year-old teenager. And there was, like, no big drug ring happening. And just that imagery of people forget. Like, she was, like, this ambassador going around, like, checking out people's homes getting completely demolished for nothing for the sake of the drug war.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's bold, man. I had no idea about that. That's pretty bold.
Yeah, I mean, and I, you know, like, our more recent work has focused a lot on DACA and issues surrounding undocumented people.
Sure,
you know, and so it varies. But I think there's always you know, a little humor, I think, is probably, like, the key for us in you know, and I mean, we're giving out tortillas. We can't take ourselves too seriously,
sure.
But at the same time, it's, like, it's kind of powerful that we're actually out there feeding people with the art that we create.
And so you're a curator at SOMA Arts. How long have you been doing that?
I started the very first show. Was, you know, my dad kind of brought me on board with him.
So he was involved for a while then with SOMA Arts.
Yes. So he had been doing the show there for maybe 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
And he brought me on board almost kind of as an intern, I would say, at first, you know, just definitely just showing me the ropes.
Yeah. And were you interested in curating by this point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely was. And so it was definitely like an apprenticeship. Mm. And, you know, I it took a couple of years for me to really kind of be sure of myself, to really feel like I had a grasp on things, to be confident, to stand by the decisions I made as a curator.
Yeah.
But all of that I learned from my dad, and it was definitely, you know, like I it was a real sense of, like, this is the family craft. Mm-hmm. Like, this is something that's being passed down from one generation to the next. And since that point, you know, my dad and I have collaborated, you know, going forward. But I've also curated other exhibits at SOMA Arts. One of the first I curated on my own was an examination of kind of cross-cultural imagery between Latinos and Japanese artists. And we actually had a lot of, we had several, well, we had an art school in Japan that participated, and they sent a bunch of artists over here. And, you know, I recruited a bunch of local, young local artists here. And a lot of that stems from, you know, seeing images of brown folks, of Chicanos, Latinos in Japan, and kind of the pop culture fascination with Chicanos in Japan, and wanting to kind of reflect that lens as well.
And historically, too, in California, the Chicano movement and then the Japanese-American civil rights movement also, like, intersect.
Well, I always think about my grandmother because, you know, my parents were born in 1942, which was kind of towards the end of World War II. And it was, you know, the kids that my parents grew up with were, because it was a large Japanese internment camp in San Diego.
That's right.
It was all of the generation of kids who were born in those internment camps were who my parents went to school with. That was because there was an internment camp there. Even when they were released, there was a large Japanese community in San Diego.
Yeah.
My grandmother could sing the Japanese national anthem and count to 10 in Japanese.
Wow.
Just from being, just from having so many Japanese friends, coworkers, and just being in that environment.
Yeah.
And so that's definitely kind of passed down through, through my mom to me. When I graduated high school, I had an internship at a Japanese publishing company. So yeah, that's definitely always been on my mind.
So, real quick, because I did look, because I, when I read on your bio of how many other people's work that you are in, like, you're not, like, not your own work and their shows or anything like that, you are literally depicted in a lot of their work. I looked it up a little bit, and one of the current works is Harry Gamboa's photo shows currently at the Autry Museum in LA, and you are, your photograph of yourself is part of that series. Explain to me the relationship with all these different artists that they felt like they loved having you included, like, or as a subject in their work.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is just knowing a lot of artists and working with a lot of artists. I think part of it is, you know, the privilege of having parents for as artists. The Harry Gamboa photographs, it was part of his Chicano Male Unbounded series, and we shot that at SOMARTS in San Francisco in the driveway there. He shot my dad and he shot me in the same night. And yeah, I think a lot of it is just, well, I would say initially a lot of it was the privilege of just being a second generation artist, of having parents being two established artists. I mean, that's, if we're being honest, that, you know, when I was, it did open some doors for me when I was younger.
Sure.
But, you know, a lot of it is just also just working with a lot of artists as a curator, going to a lot of art events and making a lot of friends, you know, and being very lucky in that as well. But I guess I've gotten around.
What was it about you, I think that they, but they liked using you as a subject in their work?
Because
I have art friends and I never get any inclusion in their work. But
I wish I could tell you, but I don't know.
So at this point, much of your work is curating, right? At this point,
yes.
Yeah. And do you still make art for yourself or anything on the side, or are you really just, your artwork really is the curatorial part of it?
You know, I do. It's more challenging these days. Mm-hmm. For about 10 years, I worked at SOMARTS, so it was very easy to put programming together while I was there, just kind of on my day job.
Yeah.
But eventually, I couldn't afford to work there, and I, you know, with rent and everything, it just wasn't feasible for me to work there.
Yeah.
So I have a 9-to-5 office job, you know, in a cubicle. And that's how I pay my bills. That's how I pay my rent. And it can be definitely challenging to have the energy to work that kind of job and then come home and have the bandwidth to do art that's personal.
And it's 9-to-5. Where's this 9-to-5 job at?
It's at a nonprofit housing organization that builds and manages accessible low-income housing throughout California.
Is that something you wanted to, like, it sounds like this is, like, up your alley, like, this working at a nonprofit like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think it definitely hits close to home, given that both my parents were evicted from their apartments and had to fight to stay in their homes and illegally squatted in their own homes for over a year.
And this is in the Mission District.
This is in the Mission District. Oh, wow. My parents have been in the same apartment building since, I want to say, 1978.
Wow.
So it's, and because of that, they couldn't really afford to live anywhere else in the area.
Yeah.
And yeah, it definitely hit close to home. My official role is office manager. So I feel like I kind of went from wrangling artists to, you know, curating and wrangling people, which I think is a good fit for what I do outside of work.
Yeah. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, I always tell this when I talk to, like, students I graduated from undergrad who are, like, want to go into the art world. They want to work in museums. They want to curate. They want to work in galleries. And I think the misconception they have is, unlike other industries where there's a automatic entry-level position to go into and then grow up, you know, into manager, supervisor, whatever, the art world, it's a little bit of a hustle. And sometimes, you know, to do what you love, you have to kind of do another job to pay the bills so you can afford the supplies and stuff you need to continue either making art or curating shows. But I think, too, just to, like, you know, be able to stay afloat, and maybe, you know, if you do well enough, like, maybe you can make a whole career out of it. Everybody's goal, I think, at this point is to try and make a career out of it, but it's not always the case, and I don't think there's a shame with it either. I mean, like, that's just part of the culture. That's part of the hustle, is what I tell people.
Yeah, I think being an artist, especially in the Bay Area, is always about finding that balance between paying the bills and reaching for your dreams.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's one answer or one surefire formula, and I think we're all kind of constantly negotiating with ourselves on what the ideal scenario is.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about a little bit what brought me here to begin with, was the Dia de los Muertos exhibit. So you and your father co-curate it together. You guys come up with a theme. And from what I understand, there's a different theme every year?
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, oftentimes the theme of the show is kind of a reflection of what's gone on in the previous year, kind of, or what's kind of going on in that moment. The theme of this year's show is resistance and remembrance. So it's both honoring the dead, as you would in traditional Day of the Dead practice, but also kind of responding to the political climate of the world we live in and the Trump administration. And, you know, the theme itself, you know, some artists adhere very closely to it, others not so much. You know, we definitely have a lot of leeway in the work that we choose for the show. I think for this one in particular, we expected it to be heavily political. And I think what was fascinating for us is that once everything took shape, that it was actually much more personal than political. And that's interesting to see that artists kind of responding to the challenges of the world we live in right now by doing incredibly personal work, and not necessarily work that directly addresses, you know, the struggles that we're facing in the face of the Trump administration.
Yeah. And, you know, and having done this and even knowing, you know, having your dad who has the history of the years probably before you were born of doing this show, how different have the themes changed? You know, like how different are they? Have they been every 10 years, you know, like have they always been, there's always a political issue that was always happening at that particular time in history that was very influential in the show? Or, you know, were there years where there was like, oh, you know, it's just very, you know, more artistic and creative, and then the next year all of a sudden it was like there's some big immigration issue and then it takes over like as a major theme of the show?
Yes. I mean, I think in terms of presidential administrations, the Obama years were very different from the George W. Bush years.
Yeah.
They were very different from the Donald Trump years. But a lot of it is organic as well, and it's not necessarily built into the show. I always think about when Hurricane Katrina happened and the kind of amazing, beautiful, and devastating work that came out in response to that. And that was nothing that we had kind of dictated in the theme of the show. It was, you know, it was still happening while the show was being mounted. Mm-hmm. But it was something that was so urgent to a lot of the artists that it shifted what they were going to do, and their responses to it were beautiful and brilliant. So sometimes it's more of an organic process. Sometimes it's something, you know, we put things out there that we seek out.
Yeah.
You know, there's that we want. And it doesn't always go that way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this year is definitely indicative of that. That the way the artists responded to a lot of the challenges, a lot of the stress, a lot of the just agony of what we're going through right now was to do something that was really personal and not necessarily just images of Donald Trump over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, we get enough of him on TV at this point. And, you know, what is your guys' goal every year out of the show? Is it to really, one, I guess, obviously social awareness, right? Like, but, like in terms of the audience that comes in, like, are you guys always hoping that it just gets more and more diverse and more like just different groups of people coming in and learning and experiencing new culture, like just new art culture and just taking it in of what's been going on in our community? Or, you know, is there like actually ever a goal to like out of putting on the Dia de los Muertos show, or just really just festive?
You know, I think in many ways, my dad and I are still trying to work that out.
Okay.
Whether we're ambassadors for Dia de los Muertos, I think the goal, and, you know, this has never really been a conversation we've had, but mm-hmm. it's to really experiment with what Day of the Dead is.
Yeah.
I feel the exhibit specifically is something that for a long time could only exist in the Bay Area mm-hmm. because there's a lot of other art spaces that have Day of the Dead shows, and they're all very traditional. Mm-hmm. And because of that, that gave us a lot of leeway to be very conceptual mm-hmm. with our work. I mean, and to really treat it as an art exhibit and not necessarily as a cultural showcase.
Right.
And so with that, we could do work that was really conceptual, that was really experimental, that took a lot of risks, that was really political, and have a lot of cultural viewpoints. I mean, the roster is for each year is very diverse. It's very international. So we're not just talking about what it means culturally in Mexican culture to honor someone that's passed away. We have, you know, this year we have artists from Mongolia. We have artists from Peru, from Venezuela, Asian American artists. We have trans artists. We have people from different that bring a lot to the show and to talk about what it means to honor the dead from their viewpoints.
Right, because every culture and every country honors the dead in some way.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the challenge is not to have someone from another culture replicate what a Mexican Day of the Dead altar is, but to really showcase and bring to the exhibit like what it means from their culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been what the exhibit has been most successful at. And so it doesn't look like any other Day of the Dead show in the Bay Area. There's, you know, we definitely have a few artists that kind of keep us rooted in being able to say, like, this is a very traditional Mexican altar. Mm-hmm. But from there, we use that as kind of a jumping off point to go in all sorts of different directions, both as, you know, presenting different cultural viewpoints, but also just really treating it as an art exhibit and taking chances and being experimental and being conceptual with it.
Yeah. Cool. How long is the show going on till?
So the show goes until November 9th.
Okay.
On the night of November 9th, we'll be having a closing reception. More information about that is available at somarts.org, somarts.org. I think for us, it's a chance to really kind of create a dialogue about death and how we honor the dead and how we celebrate the dead. I think there's, for people who aren't familiar with what Day of the Dead is, there's a real like preconception that it's about tragedy, it's about suffering, it's about loss. And I think a lot of it, the show is really presented as a celebration of life and of honoring and celebrating someone.
Yeah.
And that's really, I feel really proud about, you know, in kind of having to be so rooted in tradition, but also taking a lot of risks alongside that.
Well, cool, man. Well, thanks for coming on, man. I mean, and thanks for having me over. And it's great. And let me pick your brain about your life. I mean, it's very interesting. And I feel like I have so many more questions, but, you know, nobody wants to listen to the 3-hour podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Hopefully maybe I'll have you on again and we'll talk about some more of your other projects as time goes on.
I would love it.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Rio for coming on to the podcast. The Day of the Dead show will be at Soma Arts till November 9th, at which point there will be a closing reception. For more information about the exhibition and the closing reception, please visit somaarts.org. For more info about Rio and his work, visit his website, rioyanez.com. And finally, if you like episodes like today, be sure to leave a comment on Apple Podcasts. It helps get the word out about the Art Scene Podcast. Be sure to visit the podcast website at artscenepc.com or follow us on Instagram at Art Scene PC. All right, till next time, everyone.